The call is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the locking of a domain name subject to UDRP proceedings working group poll on Thursday, 10th January 2013. On the call today we have Laurie Anderson, Hago Dafala, Christine Durain, Lisa Garono, Celia Lerman, Michaeli Nealon, David Roach-Turner, Luke Surfer, Matt Schneller, Faisal Shah, Gabriela Slack. We have Alan Greenbank, who will be joining us later. We have apologies from David Mayer. And from staff, we have Marika Konings, Barry Cobb, Lars Hoffman, and myself, Julia Charvelin. I would like to remind all participants to state their name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
All right, thank you. Good afternoon, everybody, and, oh, yes, I'm happy 2013, year of the, I think it's the, is it the rat or a snake or something? I don't know. Mate. Anyway, as per normal, does anybody have any changes to their statements of interests and all that kind of stuff? Going once? Going twice? No. Okay, perfect. Okay, then. With the agenda today, we're looking at the updated straw man proposal, and rather than work from the most recent circulated version, we're looking at the version with notes from Luke. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Marika.
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to note that what you see up on the screen is indeed the version that Luke circulated, but I'm having difficulties in converting that into PDF, so I had to actually do a copy and paste. So what I've done is the language that you see in red was basically what was changed.
Oh, look, I'll give you a PDF.
It might not show you all the deletions, so it shows all the comments and all the changes, but if you want to see exactly what has changed or what was removed, you should look at the version that was circulated by email by Luke.
Oh, right. Did you have the issue that when you tried to print it to a PDF, Word exploded?
Exactly. You're having the same issue, I presume.
Yes.
Yeah, there must be something with the documents. I'll try to get that fixed for the next version. But I think should show sufficiently what was changed and Luke's comments as well. I think there's some of mine as well.
Okay, perfect. It's just a French thing. He's trying to kill us all or something. I don't know. Okay, Luke, you're there to answer any or clarify any questions on your suggestions, I assume.
Yes, of course.
Thank you. Merci, Luke. Okay, so actually, Word crashed because I tried to print that document. Oh, and it came back again. Okay, then. Luke's first note was in relation to remove the provision from the UDRP rules that specifies that upon submission of the complaint to the UDRP provider, the complainant should also state that a copy of the complaint has been sent or transmitted to the respondent. Now, Luke's query on this is that he thinks this is outside the working group's charter, and that it would constitute some form of UDRP reform, which, of course, as we know, has been pushed back to after delegation. Does anybody else have any thoughts on this? Oh, well, Marika does, but she's got her hand up. Marika.
Yes, this is Marika. I think this is an issue we've already spoken about on some of the previous calls, because Luke is correct that the overall reform of the UDRP is foreseen for a later point in time. But at the same time, this group has been given a mandate to look at this specific issue. I think as we discussed at that time as well, if there would be a consensus recommendation from this working group that narrow targeted change is required to address this specific issue, I don't think it would be considered outside of scope, especially if there would be as well support from the GNSO Council for such a recommendation. So, and I think as we've discussed, if that would be indeed a very targeted thing, combined with the explanations that we're looking at now, I don't think it's something that would be considered out of scope.
Okay, thanks, Marika. Luke, how do you feel about that?
No, but the UDRP rules were not to be touched and full stop. But if, like Marika said, if we can do targeted change, then let's do them.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else have any comments at this juncture? Silence means that you're giving me the... Oh, David has a comment. Go ahead, David. Oh, and Christine. Oh, my God, they've all woken up. Damn, I put that out there. Look what happened. David, then Christine.
Thanks, Michaeli. It's David speaking. Just a possible alternative course of action could be to consider that if we decide not to make a targeted amendment to the UDRP rules proper to achieve this effect, that you know, perhaps there would be scope for some sort of advisory to be, you know, issued by ICANN somehow, or that some sort of guidance could be provided that this sort of approach would be recommended, or something to this effect.
Okay, thank you. Christine?
Yeah, this is Christine from NAF, and I just wanted to say, and this is just to echo something that I believe I heard either Alan or you, Michaeli, say in the past, and that is, was there not somebody who's expressed concern that we throw all of our suggestions on the table and possibly, you know, tell the board, hey, we're aware that this might be a slight problem, or this might, you know, I thought I'd heard somewhere that the idea was to throw kind of, you know, ask for the moon and say, well, but maybe this piece isn't something we can do right now. I mean, I'm wondering if we need to put in some fudge language or something that says, yeah, we know that this might not be approved right now, or something like that. Did I mishear something about that?
Christine, it's Michaeli. I think we did discuss that in the past, and, you know, taking my chair hat off and putting my other hat on, or not wearing a hat at all, since I really don't like them. My scalp itches. I would tend to think that, you know, if you don't ask for something, you can't get it. So, you know, if it's worded in a way that doesn't upset too many people and they realize that it is narrow enough in scope, then I don't see any reason why we can't. Marika, then David.
Yeah, this is Marika, because one thing we did discuss is, I think when we started looking at the straw man, to say, okay, let's go through this and go through all the recommendations, and once we're clear on the recommendations, then maybe we take a more broader look and try to assess, okay, how are we going to implement these, or what would be the proposal, indeed, would changes need to be made to some of the rules, indeed, could we do it in the form of an advisory? So I think most of the elements we've looked at are probably more in the style of an advisory, so there wouldn't need to be any tweaking of the UDRP itself or the rules. But I think in this specific case, even though, you know, I appreciate David's suggestion, I think if in the rules it says you have to send a notification or you have to send a copy of the complaint, we can then have an advisory saying you don't have to do it. That would need to be, because then we basically have conflicting rules, basically. So I think one of the things to look at as well is that we're not changing the policy. What we're doing is making a tweak to the rules. And again, I think as Michaela says, if there is broad support amongst the working group, these recommendations are going to go out for public comment. So there, again, there's another opportunity for people to express their views on that or express concerns. I think then at that stage, the working group can have a look again and say, okay, you know, we do see serious objections. And at that stage, maybe make an assessment of whether to proceed down that path or not. But I agree with what Michaela said. If you don't put it on the table, you'll never get it in any case. So that might be a suggestion to look at it in that way.
Okay, and for the record, Matt agrees. Or if he doesn't agree, his computer agrees. And so does Laurie. David, and then Matt. Sorry, I'm just doing some of this for the transcript, since people obviously can't see what's on the screen if they're reading the transcript. And Celia's giving a plus one. David, then Matt.
Thanks, Michaeli. This is David. Just a small suggestion, I suppose, which might keep the options a little bit more open, could be to consider substituting for the word remove, adjusting.
Okay. Matt? And just for the record, Alan Greenberg will be joining the call shortly. Matt, go ahead.
Something very, very similar that we could maybe combine a little bit the suggestion on number one and number five, that we're not necessarily removing the service requirement, we're just shifting it from the complainant at the time of the initial submission of the complaint to the provider, which is already our draft recommendation number five. That might result in less physical changes to the supplemental rules if we phrase it like that.
Okay. Anybody have any other on this, or should we move on?
No comment, but Alan is here.
Hi. Welcome, Alan. We welcome you. All hail, Alan. Okay. Oh, Celia's got a hand up. Hello, Celia. Good afternoon.
Hi. Good morning here. I don't know if I I wanted to clarify my plug one. I think it would be a good idea when we put this document for public comments, maybe to put a footnote in the beginning, just clarifying this so that we understand that it is within our mandate, so that we don't get a lot of public comments just asking, well, what are you doing and everything. That's just it.
Okay. Just for the record, Celia, I will personally be delighted if we get a lot of comments and actually have a problem with the volume of comments.
Okay.
the unfortunate reality, as others will probably confirm, is that unless you've got a PDP about something to do with porn, the number of comments you're likely to get is quite low.
Well, there's an action item we can take out of that then, Michaeli.
Oh, definitely, definitely. I mean, Wendy Seltzer gave this wonderful lightning talk on takedown notices and managed to use porn like 25 times within 4 minutes, which kept the audience awake anyway. David, go ahead.
Thanks, Michaeli. I have a further thought on that draft recommendation one. It may be simpler if we would consider modifying this to an option that the filing complainant would not be obliged to copy the respondent on the filing of the complaint at that first point. And the reason I say that we could consider making it an option for the complainant rather than removing or modifying the relevant provisions is that there is a general provision under the UDRP rules which requires that one party copy the other party on all case-related communications. And this is an important provision, of course, because in general terms it ensures that both parties have relevant notice of what the others are doing. And I think it might be useful to phrase this as a specific exception to that general principle rather than looking at making an adjustment only to the relevant provision in the UDRP rules that says that the complainant has to state that a copy of the complaint has been forwarded to the respondent on filing. So it would be an addition to clarify rather than a removal.
Okay, thank you for that. I think for some of these things, I love that we're getting the feedback. I think for some of these things, it'll probably make more sense when we're actually working on an actual document itself, and maybe we can also provide rationales for various things, which may or may not make things simpler or incredibly more complicated. Alan.
Yeah, thank you.
Go for it.
I think you're right. I think we need to note that how this is implemented, there may be several options, and we need to remember all of the possibilities. I'm reminded, however, that our new CEO has said that there will be ICANN staff involvement, not just policy staff, but the actual operational staff involved when we get close to recommendations. And I think this is one of those that kind of discussion in the working group, not just later on in the implementation group, is going to be warranted and needed. So I think we need to annotate our own records to remind us that we have these options of how to specify this and revisit it at that point.
Yeah, and just also as well, I mean, we should also try and get input from compliance and legal, since they're the ones who have to implement, I suppose. Marika has her hand up, and if she says she has going to have, I know she's going to say that she gives them regular updates, better, or maybe she'll say something different. Wow. Sorry, Marika, I'm in a frivolous mood.
And I may have a comment on what Marika says, but Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. So actually to know that they have already been providing input on the straw man, and some of the comments that we have already discussed and also some that are still on the list come indeed from colleagues in those departments. I think I really like the idea that that Alan had as in outlining maybe in an initial report some of the options that may be considered in implementing this recommendation. You know, we can basically explain what our intent is and outline some of the different avenues we've explored and see as well if there's a comment from the broader community on if there's a preferred way or whether it's indeed one of those issues where people say, well, as long as it follows the intent, we don't actually really care how it's being done as long as it just ensures this really narrow change to the rules, and I'll be sure as well to get input from my colleagues. But I think in general, those kind of things, if there's a really specific preference from the working group or the community, it's helpful to include that in the report so it can be considered as part of the implementation discussions.
Okay, thanks, Marika. I mean, just two things on that. I mean, it would be helpful, at least for me. I don't know about other people, but it would be helpful if your colleagues in compliance and legal were actually just able to even forward their notes to us so we could see who it was coming from and if it was stuff that we weren't clear about, just going back to them, rather than, you know, this suggested change came from ICANN staff, but you've no idea where it came from, why it came from it, or, you know, what the thinking was, and you've no recourse. It's just suddenly, oh, ICANN staff said X, if you follow me. And I mean this in the best possible way ever, Marika. I wouldn't want to start the new year kind of beating up on you or anything like that. It's just, I know from past experience that we have had issues where when you go between, kind of move stuff further along, that stuff can get the recommendations that we as a working group thought we had come up with, and then when it went to implementation, this kind of rather large gap appeared, and it was quite hard for us to reconcile the two, and then you end up in this rather weird position where Alan and I both end up kind of going backwards and forwards, trying to work out how best to kind of diplomatically word things.
I can't Alan imagine what you're talking about, Michele.
No, of course you can't, Alan. Marika, as I said, this is just a general kind of, how do I put this? Just something that we would appreciate if you could let your colleagues know about.
Can I further comment, Michele?
Oh, please do.
Thank you. Marika is way high up on the list of people I trust to faithfully relay messages back and forth. But my interpretation of what Fatty said is that people from registrar relations or registry relations or compliance or legal, as applicable to the specific situation, would actually work with the working group at some point, not just relay messages back and forth. And I think the actual interaction and part of the discussion, we don't want to draw all their resources sitting in on boring teleconferences, but at some point I think we need to make sure that they understand the intent, and I think real interaction is going to be necessary later in the process when we get closer to actually drafting the recommendations. So it's not a matter of trusting Marika or not. I think they really need to participate, and I'm hoping that's what the intent was. But in terms of Marika, by the way, thank you, Marika. You interpreted my comment with far more thoughtfulness than I put into it when I made it, so thank you. And with that, I'll put my hand down.
Marika, is that an old hand or a new hand?
No, it is a new hand.
The new one, is it?
Yes.
I would call on her, McKaylee.
You'd what, sorry?
I would call on her and let her speak then.
All right, go on then. Marika, speak or forever hold about your peace or whatever the word is.
So this is Marika. So I think I probably need to discuss a bit further internally indeed to exactly indeed get feedback from Fadi on how he envisions that, because personally, I know we had those discussions, and I don't think it was the vision of having indeed people sit on the calls, because most of them have, you know, full-time jobs on the side that they're also doing, and, you know, we're trying as much as possible to involve them, and but also serve as a bit of a filter. So it's not that they then suddenly get dragged into working group discussions and email debates, but it's definitely our intention on keeping a close alignment between what the working group is doing and, you know, how it would fit eventually into possible implementation. And I think that's what we've already been doing here with the straw man, where I've been sending that back and forth and comments and feedback coming in. You'll also have seen that, for example, in the session that we had in Toronto, several people from legal were in the meeting and participating, as well as from compliance. So it's definitely something we envision going forward. But I'm not really sure if there's going to be any kind of formal that people assign to working groups, although there might be a kind of, I don't know, a kind of coordinator from that side, again, that serves that kind of purpose of gathering information and serving as a contact point to make sure that someone is indeed from, as, you know, maybe the other side is as such that will be involved in the implementation, involved in the discussions basically from the start, so they're able in a position as well together with, you know, the policy support, providing that kind of information to colleagues that will be involved in the implementation of the policies. And again, to note there as well that, of course, even though we try as much as possible to get input and foresee all kinds of possible scenarios, it doesn't mean that when we get to the implementation stage that there never will be situations that will go like, oh, actually, we forgot to consider that, or, oh, we didn't really think that this would happen if we would go down that route. And I think, again, there we currently have the mechanism of the implementation review teams as well, again, as a kind of mechanism where staff can liaise with community members that were involved in developing the policy to address those kind of questions or clarifications. So I think we're really trying to improve that, and hopefully with your help we'll get to a stage where you know, we have less occurrences where we come to a realization that there may be recommendations that are actually not implementable or questions that should have been addressed at an earlier stage.
Thank you, Marika.
And
Alan?
Yeah. Thank you, Marika. I don't think we're talking at odds. I certainly wasn't suggesting that we have, you know, people from all those three groups participating in the work group from the beginning. But as we get to the end, it may well be useful. I also think we need to refine the implementation review group. In the case McKaylee was talking about, those people worked for 9 months without any input and then tossed something over the wall without really, you know, sufficient explanation. And, you know, we're going to have to make the process better on all the levels. But, you know, we'll play it by ear as we go ahead. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. And, you know, again, Marika, just, you know, it's not, if there's any kind of comments coming from myself, Alan, I think they're more in general to do with PDPs and policy development in general, and not this working group or any other working group specifically, and not aimed at you or any other member of ICANN staff in particular, though we could start naming former members of ICANN staff who aren't around to defend themselves. Right. Let's move on before we get too far bogged down in trying to be diplomatic with Marika. Okay, then. Luke's next comment. I'm just trying to read this. Actually, what I'm going to do is I'm going to actually move to working from the document because I can't read that green thing.
Can you tell me where we are?
We're looking at the draft strawman proposal, draft recommendation 2. Following receipts of the complaint, the UDRP provider will, after performing a deficiency check, yada, yada, yada. And Lucas highlighted this bit. The registrar is not allowed to notify the registrant of the pending proceeding and until such moment that any changes of registrar and registrant have been prevented. See draft recommendation 3. Luke's comment. From our experience, a great percentage of the disputes we have to deal with in our capacities of registrar are solved by transfer when we, the registrar, notify the registrant. As opposed to a cease and desist letter sent to the email address, email address in whois, which could get caught by spam filters, etc., 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 the registrar's email address is known by the registrant. Registrants often claim that they are unaware of the infringement on a third party's rights and that they would be ready to transfer or delete the disputed litigious domain. He is therefore very doubtful about the positive impact of this recommendation. Sorry, Luke, I'm just paraphrasing your comment a small bit. Christine, go ahead.
Thanks. This is Christine from NAF. I would say that this suggestion under draft recommendation number 2 would not prevent what Luke is talking about. Absolutely, the registrar can notify its client and pass along information or whatever it needs to do. I mean, that's its job. I think the recommendation was really clear that you only hold off on doing that until the registrar has implemented the lock. So once the complaint has been, you know, the verification request is sent to the registrar locks the domain name, and that information should be transmitted to the registrar if they want. I mean, I don't have any objection to the registrar doing that optionally or not, if that's their business practice to not do it. The problem is to prevent cyber flight. In the UDRP, there's no, and we send this back to registrars all the time. When we request verification, we sometimes get an email back from the registrar without providing the information we asked for that simply says, hey, my client wants to transfer this name to the complainant, so just hold on while we do that. Well, we can't do that. The UDRP doesn't say, well, the provider's just going to sit around and wait for the parties to try to negotiate something. So you need to lock the domain. The registrar needs to lock the domain name. If the parties decide they want to transfer the domain name amongst themselves, they can request a stay, they can stop the process, they can do that. Or not, they can, you know, in many cases the registrar does, or the registrant does come back and say, oh, wait, I do want to transfer it, and the complainant says, no, I don't want to negotiate with you, I want to proceed with the UDRP. It doesn't really matter what all happens there. The point of this particular recommendation is to keep the UDRP process moving and not hold it up just in case somebody somewhere try to work out a deal. And so I think that both Luke's comment of trying to get the registrar, letting the registrar talk to its client and maybe, you know, helping, you know, smooth out the process, that can still happen. Just need to wait till, just get the lock on first so that the process can continue. And then if the parties want to negotiate during the UDRP, they can.
Okay. Thank you. Luke, rebuff, rebuttal or something.
Yes, just let me find the recommendation that is linked to that. Recommendation 9, I can't remember the number, but it's the recommendation basically saying that it will be the registrar task and mission to ensure that the transfer or the deletion is operated, whereas there is no UDRP decision. So this is relating to that. I'm not sure that registrar are willing to take this responsibility.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your comment, Luke. It seems like you just said something about not allowing transfer or deletion, but that's actually the requirement under the UDRP, is to, for the registrar at the notice of the UDRP, is to prevent transfer. As far as deletion goes, there's a whole separate policy that deals with that. So maybe you could clarify your point?
Okay, Luke.
Me a second. Yeah, I'm looking for the recommendation.
Okay, Luke, look, originally the question I was asking you was in relation to your second comment, which Christine didn't agree with you about, and I was asking you if you had anything to add or anything to come back to her with.
So not at the moment.
Okay, thank you.
I think Luke is talking about his comment 13, which I don't think we've gotten to yet.
No, we haven't. That's what I was trying to sort out. Okay. Does anybody else have any thoughts on Luke's second comment Okay, I will put in something. I'm take my chair hat off and put my registrar hat on. I understand what Luke's talking about. I mean, we have seen similar type of behavior. Sorry? Hello? Okay, moving on. Next one. Draft recommendation 3. The registrar will prevent any changes to the registrar and registrant within one business day. Oh, sorry, I have to read it from the... Sorry, I have to go back to reading it from the Word document. The registrar will prevent any changes of registrar and registrant within one business day at the latest following receipt of verification. Then Luke's comment on this entire section here. If his question is a simple one, as pointed out by Marika, if no one notifies the registrant, how can the lift happen? This is the lifting of the privacy proxy service. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika, because it links a bit together with my comment, the previous one here, and we touched upon it a little bit on the last meeting, but I don't think, or at least I didn't get any clear guidance on what we need to do with that, because basically the question is that does the lifting of privacy and proxy services require communications with the registrant, or is that an automatic action that the registrar would take? Basically, it's automatically lifted without any need for communication. But if there is a need to communicate with the registrant to say, hey, your privacy proxy is now going to be lifted and your real identity is going to be revealed, that obviously requires a communication and a potential as well notification or alert to the registrant that there's a UDRP proceeding. So just trying to figure out whether there needs to be any kind of exception in this case, or whether, you know, the agreements that are currently in place foresee a kind of automatic, like if we get a UDRP proceeding, we automatically lift without a need to tell you, that's just the way it is. Or so I'm trying to get some clarification on whether there needs to be any kind of exception or specific provision on how to deal with communications in relation to privacy and proxy services.
Okay, thank you, Marika. Alan, and then Volker, and could somebody tell me which line is the one with the weird background noises? Because it's not mine. Alan, go ahead.
I think we're confusing issues of, you know, when the privacy service is the registrar itself. Typically, the privacy service is by definition the registrant as far as the registrar is concerned, until it's lifted. And our rule, our new implication is that we cannot notify the registrant until it's locked. So if the registrant is the privacy service, they're still a registrant, and they can't be notified at that point. So the sequence has to be the lock is put on, and the registrant is notified. The registrant may well be a privacy service who may choose to, based on their agreement with the real beneficial registrant, to lift privacy at that point or not. That's not our problem. But from the point of view of the formal complaint, the privacy service is the complaint is the respondent until it's changed. If I understand correctly,
sir, what's the formal respondent, Alan?
If I file a UDRP, I'm filing it against whoever is in who is as the owner of the domain name, which shows the privacy service. Well, it depends on whether it's privacy or proxy. It may show the real person's name, or it may show the front. But in any case, that's the only registrant we know about until after the lock is done under what we're recommending in two.
Okay. I'm just going to read for the record a couple of things from Laurie on the chat. Laurie from GoDaddy. Lifting of privacy and implementation of the lock occurs almost simultaneously at GoDaddy domains by proxy. The domains by proxy customer is notified, but the domain is already locked. Matt, question about contracts. Christine, the lock's distinct from the who is. Luke points out that GoDaddy is acting as both the registrar and the proxy provider. Luke's point also points out that as they're not providing the service, so if no email is sent to the proxy provider, they'll never know about the proceedings. So there's a bit more on that. Volker and then Christine.
Sorry, I'm mute there. If I remember correctly, the UDRP provides for an ability to update the ownership record of the domain name during a dispute if the new owner accepts to be bound by that dispute as well. Now, this is usually the transfer we do allow when we have a lock under consultation with the provider. And I think in this case, it might be helpful to make it to make the lock placed by the registrar a qualified lock, as in no updates may be progressed by anybody else but the registrar. And the registrar may, in certain circumstances, such as the lifting of WHOIS privacy services and the notification of the provider within a certain time, remove the privacy service and insert the real registrant if it's informed about that data, if the real registrant abides by the UDRP rules. I think it's Section 8A of the UDRP policy at the progress. So basically what I'm saying, make it qualified lock, nobody else but the registrar in communication with the provider can change it, but allow a change in certain service circumstances, such as the revealing of the underlying registrant.
Okay, thank you, Volker. Christine and then Matt.
Hey, this is Christine from NAF. I sort of wanted to echo some of what Volker just said, which is the need to put the lock first, and then, you know, if the who is the privacy information has to update, then that happens. But the point I think that the providers are making, and I don't mean to speak for David out of turn, is that if there's going to be a lifting of the privacy service, it does need to happen, you know, in that same sort of period. So the provider sends an email saying, please lock the domain name, provide us with the underlying registrant. In that order, lock the domain name, let us know who's registered the domain name. If you have to go, like, solicit that information from somebody because you don't happen to have, and, you know, you've got to do that quickly. Also within that same business day, you've got to, you know, get that information back to us quickly. You know, GoDaddy or Domains by Proxy are usually able to do that simultaneously because they're all, you know, they're linked. Some places aren't, but most of the time we do get that information back, you know, relatively quickly and make a decision. The big problem just is, you know, the dragging of the feet between when we request the notice, you know, and then, you know, the registrar has to wait, you know, 5 days or 10 days for their proxy provider to get back to them. Well, the UDRP process isn't set up to wait for that. And I think that's really just the concern, not that you can't lift the proxy or privacy service, but that needs to, you know, kind of happen in a relatively, you know, expeditious manner.
Okay, thank you. Matt, and then Marika.
Just wanted to revisit a question that David had raised a little while ago. At some point earlier, he made the comment that 8A and 8B, the provisions of the UDRP that talk about transfers during a dispute, specifically refer to actually, never mind. We've gone over this before. There's no point. Sorry.
Okay, well, you can always come back via the mailing list as well. And also, people, if you wake up in the middle of the night and you have a burning desire to share your latest thoughts and ruminations on the wonderful world of UDRP lock, don't be afraid. There's a mailing list available to you 24/7, 365, just waiting for your input. Translation, use the mailing list, please. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. One thing we've discussed before, and one of the challenges is if there would be any kind of exceptions for changes done by privacy or proxy services. The challenge, again, is how do we identify which are valid or authorized privacy and proxy services? Because as we currently don't have an accreditation program, there's no way of for registrars at least to identify whether they're dealing with a legitimate privacy proxy service or whether it's just someone saying, I'm a privacy proxy service, but actually just changing, or transferring out or changing the registrant details. So I think one of the reasons why the initial strawman went along the line of saying, well, the domain is logged, no changes are made. If indeed there is a lifting, that communication should go directly to the UDRP panel was basically for those reasons, and basically maybe there should be an accompanying recommendation that says, as part of the discussions on privacy proxy services accreditation, this issue should also be considered. So that's one of the, because I think Volker was talking about making a possibly kind of exception where even after the log, changes could be made based on privacy proxy reveal, but then we're in the situation, how do we indeed verify that those are legitimate services that are requesting those changes?
Okay, thank you, Marika. And who's up next? Matt, that's an old hand, I assume.
This is a new one, actually. Just following
okay,
up
sorry,
on...
Sorry, go ahead.
I think one of the pluses, maybe, of the way it's currently structured, with simply a number of days, or however we end up describing this, the business day or whatever, is that we don't have to make that decision about what a legitimate privacy service is or isn't or whatever. The lock simply has to be applied to whatever the current information is at that point. And it keeps us from having to get into the details of privacy, proxy, whatever other sort of changes. You just don't have to deal with it if we take this approach.
Okay. Volker. And Happy New Year, Volker. I'm sorry for not saying so to you earlier.
Thanks, Mikhail. It's same to you. I'm just thinking about something that we came across during the RAA negotiations, and that's still very much on topic for those negotiations, and is going to be processed probably after we reach conclusion on that. Is the program for accreditation of privacy services, and a lot of the issues and questions that I hear here would likely go away once privacy proxy services are accredited and. And at that point, the question will no longer be have to be raised if a privacy proxy service is a legitimate service or it's just we're trying to find a way around. So we might just want to prepare whatever we are drafting to allow by referencing, for example, to accredited or legitimate privacy services and allowing, in those cases, for a lock to be removed just to make this policy that we're creating future-proof.
Okay, thank you. Marika and then Alan.
This is Marika. I'm basically commenting on what Matt said because I think that's basically where my question and I think also Luke's question relate to, because if you indeed leave it for that, those communications or that lifting to be done before the domain name is logged, the question is still, does that require communication with the registrant? If it doesn't, I think it's fine and nothing we need to worry about here. But if it does require communication with the registrant before the lock is applied, we need to build in some kind of exception in relation to the recommendation on the draft recommendation too, because there we're saying the registrar is not allowed to communicate with the registrant. Or maybe we're interpreting it, the registrar will communicate with the privacy proxy service, and what they do is up to them. So basically, I mean, I guess that's a way of reading it as well.
Hold on. Slow down a second. Sorry, Marika. I'm trying to process all that, and my brain is failing, and English is my first language. Yes, please, because I got lost somewhere after like the second or the third exchange and was getting completely confused. Go ahead.
Okay. So basically in draft recommendation 2, we're saying the registrar cannot communicate with the registrant until the lock is applied. In draft recommendation 3, we're saying if there are changes to privacy proxy services, if there's any lifting that needs to be done, that needs to happen before the lock is applied. So the question is, does the lifting of privacy proxy services require communication between the registrar and the registrant, which would mean that it violates our recommendation in number two, or it doesn't violate that communication? Because, as I said, maybe it's only communication then from the registrar to the privacy and proxy service, and it's up to the privacy proxy service whether they need to contact the registrant or not, and that's at this stage without our remit, and, you know, again, it might be something that's considered as part of the accreditation program. So I think I'm just trying to get clarification on that, whether we're recommending something that's actually conflicting and we need to provide for some kind of exception, or whether, as it's currently written, it's fine, and in that case there wouldn't be any violation of the rules we're prescribing under draft recommendation 2. Is that clear?
This is Christine. Can I ask a clarifying question before we go on?
Please do.
Okay. I really thought that we've discussed at great length over the past few weeks that and I know we still have to define lock, so that may be part of the problem, but I thought that updating the WHOIS data was a step apart from the lock. So the registrar can apply a lock, and if they then want to call up the proxy service or whoever's listed as the respondent and say, are you really a proxy service, whatever it is they need to do there, that they can do that with having a lock. So that once that registrar calls the registrant and says, hey, I want to know if you want to release the privacy service or unlock, you know, reveal that, then they can't transfer the domain away, but they can still update the WHOIS record. And so I'm very confused. Did I misunderstand for the past several weeks?
This is Marika. If I can respond, because I understood, because I think the way we've written it, and I'm trying to find that exact language, I think what we said, that the only changes that could be made are corrections to contact data. And if we're indeed interpreting that as broad as being, it could mean changing the name of the registrant, I think we need to clarify that. I had understood it only as in updating, oh, you know, my phone number is not right, or, oh, it's my old address that is there and needs to be corrected. I didn't interpret that discussion as meaning that could also be the lifting of privacy and proxy, so having completely new details. So if that is the intention of the working group, I think we need to clarify that in the relevant section.
It's Alan. Can I get in? Because I think I can perhaps help.
Go ahead, Alan.
Yeah. Volker alluded to one of the problems, that we're in a transition mode at this point, that we think we're going to have accredited privacy and proxy services. We don't know for sure, and we don't know when. And I think how we're going to word these recommendations are going to be different depending on whether it's before or after accreditation exists as a formal process. And I think we almost need a double path of having different rules depending on which set of rules we're working under. Because if we're working under the rules where the registrar knows and can tell by a flag or something that the registrant of record is a proxy service, their process will be different, or may be able to be different than if they don't know that right now. And right now, they, you know, obviously, if it's domains by proxy and it's GoDaddy, they know. And in many of the other cases, if it's a captive or a subcontracted proxy service, then you know. But in other cases, you cannot tell that this is a lawyer who is, you know, pretending to be the registrant. And I think, for clarity, we may want to have two sets of recommendations. Now, if we knew for sure what the timing of proxy privacy certification was in relation to when this PDP is going to work its way through the system, we only need one of those paths. We may only need one of those paths. But I think we almost want to have two different sets of rules, because the rules will be different if a registrar knows for sure this is a proxy service. And if the registrar knows for sure this is not a proxy service, then one would not change the registrant of record. by not being accredited, you are taking responsibilities for any domain you apply for.
Okay.
And so I think we need to think of the two modes and not try to have a single set of words which are going to apply to both scenarios, because right now the registrar cannot know for sure that it's a proxy service. And
unless they run the proxy service.
Cannot notify the registrant to reveal the proxy service, which they know exists. So.
Okay, this is Michele speaking as your chair, a.k.a. cat herder, a.k.a. whatever. We've got about 4 minutes left. I have four people in the queue. Alan has spoken, so that means three. So I'll do Marika, Volker, and Mass, and bearing in mind how little time is left, could you please keep it as to the point as possible, please?
Yes, this is Marika, and I can even speak faster than I did before, but I won't. Just a note that on the point of changes after LOC has applied, people may want to look as well to draft recommendation 8, because there we specifically talk about the fact that if there are any changes as a result of lifting of privacy proxy services following the locking, that would need to be discussed, addressed by the UDRP panel directly. And we say also there that that should be further reviewed as part of the privacy and proxy accreditation program. So again, if there's misunderstanding, it looks like we need to make some changes, although I saw in the chat as well that some people had interpreted it in the same way as I did. On the privacy and proxy accreditation program, I do understand, but maybe Volker can clarify who's next in the queue. I think that does need to go or will go through a PDP eventually. I think they're working on a kind of draft proposal, but I think in order for it to become binding at the end of the day, it will require a PDP. So it is likely that it would come after this group concludes its work. So I don't know if it's indeed then something that this working group can just refer to that PDP and say, hey, when you're doing that, look at what we did and make sure that you either address or any other issues that need to be resolved as part of your work, do that as well. So, but again, maybe Volker has more information on that.
Volker, you're up. 2 minutes, everybody.
Yes, Marika is fully correct. We're providing a straw man that will be a basis for a later PDP. Just to quote from our current procedures, or describing our current procedures when we receive a UDRP, we look at the domain name. Does it have our own US privacy service? If it does, we turn that off, and then we lock. If it doesn't have our own privacy service, but we know that there's a privacy service under there, we lock, then inform WIPO or NAF that there is a privacy service, but with the lock remains, but we will only inform them if we get information from the registrants. So the lock stays on there effectively. It would be helpful if we would have a way to update, which we do not have today in cases where the privacy service is not ours, but it is well-known privacy services, for example, of one of our resellers. Because the difference between our own privacy services in operations and privacy service by a third party does not really make sense. We react to the email that says there's a complaint. We lock as soon as we've taken the necessary steps, and then we inform either parties and the provider about the information that we have on record. Because we have other information on record, we think that it's viable to turn off the service in our own cases, but we cannot do that with third party whose privacy is provided at this time, which would be helpful for the results of the UDRP and for attributing blame, if I may say so, for registrations that does not necessarily belong to the whose privacy provider that ends up being the party of record in the UDRP proceedings, the complaining party.
If I had a bell or a horn, I would use it at this juncture. It is 4 o'clock. It is the top of the hour. Matt, if you have any comments or anything, could you please send them to the list and we can all look at them there. Thanks, everybody, for your time today. And if you haven't had a look over the latest version of the document with Luke's notes. Would you please do so? And hopefully speak to you all next week. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Michaela.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Sorry for being late.
Bye-bye.